Welcome to Alternative Realities. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, Global Market Strategist at JP Morgan Asset Management. While there's been a great deal of disruption in trade this year due to tariffs and policy uncertainty, countries and businesses are adjusting in real time to keep the flow of trade moving. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by a guest who's very familiar with the ins and outs of global trade, Andy Dacey, CEO and CIO of JP Morgan Asset Management's Global Transportation Group, and an investor with over 30 years of experience in the transportation sector. On today's episode, we will discuss how the current trade and tariff turmoil is impacting the transportation sector, how shipping patterns have had to adapt to geopolitical events around the world, the possibility of bringing back shipbuilding to the United States, and some of the opportunities that exist in transportation outside of shipping. Let's get started. Andy, thank you for joining us on Alternative Realities.
It's great to be here, Aaron. Really appreciate you having me on today.
Before we get started, could you give our audience some background on your career, what drew you into the shipping industry, and how that's shaped your role here at JP Morgan?
Sure. I was always interested in international trade. I grew up in London, and then I studied Chinese economics and development during college. And so I had an exposure to the world at large growing up. And when I was looking for something to do with my life from a career perspective, stumbled into shipping, admittedly. But once I had, I realized it had that global perspective and international trade orientation that I'd been looking for. So it was a combination of something I was wanting, but also something that I fell into.
Okay. So similar kind of background to my own in terms of like international development. I actually started my career in Russia, and one of the first deals I ever worked on in M&A advisory was the acquisition of a stake in a container terminal outside St. Petersburg.
Interesting. Is that Ust-Luga by any chance?
It was Ust-Luga, indeed. Yeah.
Okay. I had some interactions with that company that owned that business a while back, but that's probably for another podcast, I suspect.
Yeah, I've been fascinated with the container business, the transportation business more broadly ever since. So really excited to have you on here and talk about this industry. So before we get into some of the more timely themes around trade and tariffs, I think a good place to start a conversation is maybe at a more fundamental level. How can an investor make money investing in the transportation sector?
Well, look, the transportation sector is quite broad, right? It has certainly shipping, as we just mentioned. It also has the aviation industry. It has land-based transport of different types. You have rail, you have busing, a whole range of different ways of getting involved in it. The way we like to think of it, because in addition just to all the different verticals I talked about, there's also different regional impacts. And our focus is really on trying to smooth out any degree of volatility that might exist. We're heavily active in the shipping space, as we just alluded to, and shipping historically has and can have volatile components to it. Our approach is to find the longest duration leasing opportunities that we can achieve, and certainly that becomes easier with scale. So as you grow and you develop a bigger portfolio, smoothing out future volatility is certainly central to how we think about it. And our goal, like I said, is long-term leases, high-quality counterparties, really predictable cash flow, which is what, in our particular case, investors are looking for. We may not get the highs, or we may not get the lows, but we're really designed to cut down the middle of the fairway and to mitigate, frankly, any potential volatility with the shock absorber of the counterparties that we lease our assets to. And they typically, since they're mostly investment grade, they have strong balance sheets. They're the ones that are really facing the market, and they make a commitment to us to take our assets for long periods of time, which gives us the confidence and the security to deliver that cash flow to our investors.
Okay, so it's a different experience, would you say, from investing in a public shipping company, for example?
Yeah, because of our long-term contracted cash flow orientation, there's plenty of public shipping companies that will take a much different approach. They may take a lot of short-term risk. They may be exposed to what's known, particularly in the shipping market, as the spot industry or the spot sector. And these are typically sort of single voyages or maybe 3 to 6 month voyages. And there you're constantly sort of dealing with market changes. And while you may be able to take advantage of significant upticks in the market, at the same time, you'll be exposed to potential downturns. Our focus, like I said earlier, is really to just smooth that out. So you'll be accepting more volatility if you're looking at a company publicly traded that takes on that type of risk.
Now, out of all the alternative asset classes, transportation might be the one that's most heavily impacted by geopolitical events, policy, and so on. Can you provide some color on this? Is this true? And how have you seen trade change in response to tariffs and policies and other disruptions this year?
Well, it's been an interesting 4 or 5 years moving into what's been happening in the last 6 months with the new U.S. administration. If you go back to the pandemic, when that emerged back in 2020, so 5 years ago, at the time, no one in the industry really had any idea of how it was going to impact the industry. What we found as the pandemic unfolded was that with all the lockdowns, the impact on travel was certainly significant, but people were being supported by governments in different parts of the world with various forms of financial support. And that resulted in this phenomenon that I think is commonly known as the Amazon effect. People were sitting in their houses, they were ordering a lot of things. They weren't going out to eat, they weren't going to the movies. And what that did is that resulted in a significant uptick in demand going through the supply chain. So at the time, you couldn't really build new ships because of the lockdowns that occurred globally. China was heavily locked down. So you had a lot of demand increase against a pretty fixed supply. And that resulted in a significant uptick in rates. And what that did is it set the tone for dislocations that began to occur, starting with the pandemic, which this was followed by the Russian invasion of Ukraine. That resulted in various forms of sanctions that prevented ships from going the Black Sea into Europe, which were traditional routes. Because Russian oil exports were sanctioned, those ships had to go longer distances to more, at least friendly to Russia, jurisdictions for refining that particular crude, which is then re-exported. So that resulted in dislocations that consumed supply. Ships had to travel greater distances to deliver their cargo. So there were fewer units of cargo capacity available because of these extensions in trade. And that really pushed up rates. So there was a lot of cash flow that was built up in the shipping industry. The pandemic did it, the dislocations from the Russia-Ukraine war, that was further exacerbated with what happened with the Houthis in the Red Sea, that also extended trade routes and consumed supply. So we've come out of a period of time which was very positive for shipping in particular. Aviation, of course, is a different story. It suffered during the pandemic, but it's seen a post-pandemic rebound. Now, as we move into trade issues, as you just mentioned, in terms of what's been happening more recently with tariffs, I think that the impact is still yet to be seen. We've seen a couple of different chapters or small chapters in the last couple of months. Initially, the Trump administration came out really strong with some pretty significant tariffs on China in particular. As we know, those were rolled back about 2 or 3 weeks ago. I think in the weeks since, it's been a little more difficult to achieve perhaps some of the outcomes that both sides are looking for. I don't think we're going back to that 145-125% range. But what I do think is we'll see some leveling out of tariffs. I think both sides, despite some acrimony, want to find a happy medium. And where that ends up is hard to tell. But if you look forward and you accept the fact that tariffs will be higher than they were prior to the current administration, I think we're seeing a couple of things happening. I think the rest of the world is not so keen on protectionism in the same way that the U.S. at least appears to be. As a result of that, we're seeing different developments in trade that are occurring outside of the U.S. For example, the EU has been in negotiations for many years about importing Chinese EVs in a more methodical way. We've just seen recently their willingness to now accept higher imports at minimum price levels, but at levels that were below where they would have accepted that recently. India and the UK had a long sort of running debate over what their new trade regime is going to look like. That came to a conclusion in the last couple of weeks. We're beginning to just see more countries globally finding ways to actually accelerate trade. And I think that's going to be somewhat to the detriment of the U.S. Now, the U.S. is still clearly the largest global economy and nobody can ignore it. But I do think the rest of the world is saying, all right, given that this is perhaps the state of play for the next 4 years or 3.5 years, how do we reconsider or reevaluate our trade activities? And we're seeing new trade routes develop just in the last few weeks in terms of more exports from South America going to Europe, which historically had gone to the U.S. Exports, of course, of agricultural products now similar to what happened during the first Trump administration will most likely be rerouted to South America to be re-exported back to or onwards to China or Asia. So trade tends to find a way, and at least at first read, that seems to be the case now. And you know, like the rest of the world is just reconfiguring itself as a result of what's happened. And also, I would say that the U.S.'s attempts to really drive a hard bargain, I think, are finding various constraints that they're coming up against. I think, as we all know, Japan had been approached by the U.S. administration to really renegotiate their trade and agreement, and they came back to the U.S. administration and said, look, we're open to doing something, but we also have to recognize the fact that we are here in Asia and China is a very important part of our future. And at least the signal appeared to be, we're not willing to wholesale abandon the importance of that future relationship in favor of a much more favorable U.S.-Japan trade agreement. So the world, I think, is different than it used to be 30, 40 years ago. And I think the realities of that are becoming a big part of how we're going to think about the future.
Okay, so it's become that there's a willingness to continue to trade between different countries, but it's become a more maybe inefficient trade environment in terms of ships taking longer distances. And you're already seeing the effect of trade routes being changed and disrupted.
Absolutely. And I think that inefficiency is, for shipping at least, a positive. The pandemic demonstrated that. Sanctions in Russia demonstrated that. The closure of the Red Sea demonstrated that. So oddly enough, shipping has proven to be a geopolitical hedge. The more geopolitical tension, the more unusual routes have to be created to move around that geopolitical tension. We'll see how it unfolds in this next sort of wave of geopolitical tension that we've been talking about, particularly the U.S. tariffs. The global economy is a large one, and of course the U.S. is a big part of that, but there's still a lot of activity out there that is not necessarily U.S. driven. Yeah. And I think that'll become the watchword of trade, at least for the next few years.
That's a fascinating way to look at it, as shipping as a geopolitical hedge. I haven't heard that before. And if you break it down in terms of the different types of shipping that you're involved in, and how do you look at these from an investment lens, container ships maybe being different from bulk ships and the other types of shipping?
Sure. So in our particular case, we're in numerous subsectors of shipping. I think just to drill down on some particular examples and how they've been impacted by geopolitics, and container shipping is probably the one, at least from a tariff perspective, that's going to have the most significant impact. When you think about the amount of exports from China that go to the U.S., which I believe is somewhere around $550 billion, the received wisdom, at least in the past couple of months, is that if tariffs had gone up to 145%, which would have made any exports from China for very basic goods almost untenable going into the U.S., China was of the view, and again, I don't know how much of this is sort of aspirational and how much of it's real, but I think there is some reality to it, that about 50% of that $550 billion could be redirected to other destinations. So there would have been, let's say, a $250 billion impact to Chinese exports. I think, while not fantastic for the Chinese economy, that was something they were considering and willing to weather. And I suspect their ability to take a pretty firm stance when they were confronted with the initial round of tariffs was a reflection of the fact that they had some confidence they could redirect some of those exports. A lot of those exports, particularly the manufactured goods, obviously go on container ships. And we were seeing, you know, immediately some rerouting of some of those container ships into Southeast Asia, into India for transshipment purposes, as well as into Africa. Now, those can be rerouted again quite easily. So I think, again, like I said earlier, time will tell, but there are levers that various economies around the world can pull to sort of redirect trade, particularly in the container ship sector. Other sectors are, like I was saying, less affected by U.S. tariffs. In fact, they may be, frankly, more negative for the U.S., liquid natural gas being one of them. The U.S. exports a lot of liquid natural gas. The last thing they want to see is retaliatory tariffs on U.S. sourced natural gas. I do think that one of the realities, or one of the things that came out of the war in Ukraine, is the fact that Europe is reassessing where it's going to source its natural gas. While natural gas is still not fully sanctioned, obviously the amount of natural gas being piped from Russia into Europe has fallen precipitously, down by about 90%. And I think as the European Union looks forward and thinks about where it's going to get its energy from, we've seen this since the war broke out 3 years ago, a lot more liquid natural gas import is happening. New liquefaction plants that were fast-tracked in Germany and other parts of Europe to accept that natural gas into Europe, other sources, the U.S. being one of them, as well as the Middle East. So that's just one real-world example of how one particular sector of shipping was actually dramatically benefited by the geopolitical sort of military component of what was happening on the land in Europe with the war in Ukraine. By the same token, the product tanker and the crude tanker market, the U.S. actually exports crude as well as refined petroleum products. So clearly, the U.S. doesn't want to see significant retaliatory tariffs on exports on U.S. sourced crude and U.S. sourced refined petroleum products. So I think there'll be a more balanced approach to how tariffs for those particular commodities are addressed. And there's a lot of trade in those particular sectors out of the Middle East into different destinations. Talked about Russia's exports of crude. I do think that, well, maybe China and India and other parts of the world are less concerned about what's happening in Ukraine. The West, broadly defined, will continue to be fairly cautious around accepting any sort of Russian-sourced crude going forward. So I think that bifurcation of trade will impact that. But frankly, what that does, as I said earlier, it just causes longer trade distances to actually get the commodity to where it needs to go, which is favorable for shipping. I'll stop there. I could talk about a lot of subsectors, but here's some real-world examples, at least, of how geopolitics affects particular sectors in shipping.
Yeah, it's fascinating how that's evolved just in recent years, even before the tariffs, U.S. becoming a net exporter of natural gas and petroleum products, and then the pipelines being cut off, of course, in Europe at a very opportune time for the U.S. as it became a net exporter. So that's coming together, of course, with trade and tariffs. So yeah, fascinating. You've got a kind of a seat in the middle of seeing all this stuff happen. And seeing the trade being rerouted in real time. Coming back to policy, one of the goals of the U.S. administration is to bring back manufacturing to the U.S. And I'm curious how you see this in relation to shipbuilding. You mentioned shipbuilding earlier and not being able to meet the demand for ships globally. Do you see the U.S. becoming a bigger player in the shipbuilding industry? How do you see this playing out?
Look, I think there are going to be significant milestones that will have to be achieved to accomplish these two goals that you talked about. One is bringing manufacturing back substantially to the U.S. being one of them, and I'll talk about shipbuilding in a second. But when it comes to manufacturing in the U.S., I believe manufacturing represents about 7% of the total U.S. economy. So let's say even in a very favorable outcome, we were able to double the amount of manufacturing that occurs in the U.S., the impact on the U.S. economy would not be that dramatic. It's still largely a service-based economy. I think right. Doubling it is going to be a challenge. I think we have labor issues. There's cost differentials. Making a product in the U.S. just unfortunately is more expensive and more costly in most cases than it is making it overseas. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking at ways of doing it domestically. And certainly with advancements in, let's say, some technology and AI, I think maybe some of that cost structure could be streamlined. And as the U.S. is a leader in a lot of those different technological developments, there's probably a merging of that could enhance that growth. But I think going from 7 to 8 or 9% is probably more realistic, but it's going to take time. There's permitting issues. There's location issues. There's a whole series of labor that I talked about. Like, this doesn't happen overnight. So I think that's something that's going to take a while. And shipbuilding, in a way, almost reflects some of the challenges that more general manufacturing may experience. And so the U.S., for example, I think built 3 deep-sea vessels in 2024. China, just by way of comparison, built something on the order of 1,800 ships that year. So you have a significant disparity by no means anywhere close. One of the biggest challenges is the labor situation. To build a ship in the United States, it's probably a factor of 4 to 5 times as expensive as it is to build it in Asia, China, South Korea, or Japan. So if you're building a ship that, let's say, in Asia costs $100 million, you're going to spend $500 million to build it in the U.S., you're going to be very limited in terms of where you can actually trade that ship. You're not going to be able to compete with the vast majority of ships that trade internationally. So to the extent that there's a protected market in the US, and there is one called the Jones Act. It's not a very big market, only has about 100 ships in it today. Then maybe there's some small incremental growth that's available there. But to build ships domestically with that cost differential issue, that are going to compete internationally, I think is going to take a very, very long time. And another issue that I'll mention on that front, which is,
and you mentioned the Jones Act there. Could you refresh us on what the Jones Act is in relation to domestic U.S. shipping?
Sure. So the Jones Act is a protectionist piece of legislation that was passed in the 1920s that basically stipulates any vessel that trades in the United States that trades domestically from one U.S. port to another U.S. port has to be built in the U.S., has to be crewed at least 75%, sorry, has to be crewed 100% by U.S. crew members. On top of that, it has to be at least 75% owned by a U.S. National entity of some sort. So no foreign ownership of any meaningful sort. The Jones Act, as I mentioned, is down to just shy of 100 ships. The average age in the Jones Act is roughly about 40 years of age. And the reason for that is because of how expensive it is to build a new ship in the U.S., the default approach is just to extend the life of ships that were built many years ago. So it's a little bit of a challenge situation, to say the least. And also the demand is not that dramatic. Intra-state seaborne trade in the U.S. is really obviated by what happens on a land-based basis, which is more efficient given how big the U.S. is. You can ship something over rail or by truck much more quickly sometimes, let's say going from New York around Florida into Louisiana, just as an example. So anyway, that's the Jones Act. And it's a reflection of sort of how difficult it will be to build ships in the U.S. going forward.
Yeah, so very, very challenging to bring shipbuilding really back to the U.S. And we're already seeing that with the Jones Act, just that 100 ships in the U.S. that are moving domestically that have to be built in the U.S.
Yeah, so, and that's not to say there won't be some projects that get done. There's a lot of initiative. The administration, I think, is talking about subsidies, but those subsidies, of course, have to be balanced against the real world economic impact. And I think developing jobs, developing expertise is important, but it'll just take time. It's a noble undertaking, but there's going to be a time factor that will impact that development.
Okay. And beyond shipping, where are you finding opportunities within transportation in other sectors? Are there other areas that have growth potential in today's environment?
So transportation continues to be the lifeblood of, as I said, global trade, certainly international travel with aviation, domestic transport with land-based travel like rail, as well as busing. So we see opportunities in all those different sectors. And for us, at least specifically, they have to follow that long-term lease opportunity with high-quality counterparties. So by definition, perhaps our ability to invest in sort of more volatile sectors is certainly not pursued nor desired. But given that globally we're talking about an industry it's in the multiple of trillions of dollars, and depending on how you cut it, let's just say if you're going to take shipping, aviation, rail, and exclude land-based busing, for example, then you're well north of $3 trillion. So there's plenty of opportunities. It's clear, obviously creating the right portfolio, the right diversification, and the right counterparty matrix for us specifically. So we like the fact that each one of these subsectors of transportation does not beat to the tune of the same drum. We talked about in the pandemic when shipping was doing fantastically and aviation was not doing so great. There were opportunities on a relative basis to think about how you might allocate capital between those two sectors. So we continuously watch the market and deploy capital where we see those relative opportunities. And it's a robust market globally. The industry, on average, across all those sectors, has grown around 2-2.5% for the last 30 years. And I don't see any reason why it should stop going forward.
So a lot of opportunities, even beyond shipping, to look at investing in transportation.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining me on Alternative Realities.
It was a real pleasure to be here, Aaron. I really enjoyed it and look forward to doing it again.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by J.P. Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable, but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. J.P. Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of J.P. Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.